were we to open up our eyes and start living spiritual lives and stop with the corruption and the greed and the materialism and the atheism and the things that are destroying the world, if we were to get rid of these things and start loving and having compassion and love and leading with that love and unity and the oneness of humanity, we would instantly have such a paradise that the earth would be unrecognizable.
Hi, and welcome to the first English spoken episode of my podcast, Imperfect on Purpose. This is something that I want to do more in the future, so the timing was perfect with this week's guest being Steve Saurovich. Steve is the founder of Pelocity, philanthropist, and humanitarian. He is the co-founder of Wayfair Studios, whose efforts in entertainment are focused on creating impactful, purpose-driven content. He is also a dedicated member of the Baha'i Faith, which we also touch upon in this episode. Our conversation went in many directions, among others how love and conscious choices can change the world, to make sure that both heart and mind are heard when we make decisions, breathing, philanthropy, and why great wealth should be shared. And then, of course, we also talked about movies and stuff. So here we go, guys. Enjoy.
We're primarily spiritual beings, and so we live in this world where our spirit is essentially in jail. You know, we lock them away and pretend it doesn't exist, and we don't feed our spirit. And because of that, we feed ourselves all sorts of other things that aren't as good for us instead of spiritual food. You know, love, kindness, prayer, meditation, service to humanity. If we acknowledge our spirit, just like our body, you know, I think here in Denmark, from what I can see, there's a lot of people who are very fit and active. And I happen to be, even though I'm American, also in that same camp. I'm very careful to stay fit and active, and I love to do that. Mm. But if you neglect your body, that's a problem. And we don't think anything of neglecting our spirit, but many of us wouldn't neglect our bodies. Our spirit, I believe, is much more important than our bodies. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, the whole story about Imperfect on Purpose is kind of, you know, what we're trying is to kind of connect the heart and the mind to make people that want to go ahead and pursue their dreams. I mean, to make sure that both young and also mature people don't achieve that dream and then stand on top of that mountain completely unhappy, stressed out, just destroyed as a human, you know?
For me, I'm really grateful that I found the Baha'i Faith at the time I did, because my company went public. I made the Forbes 400 a couple of years. I'm a little off it now, but still doing okay. I'm not starving. But for me, it was really good when I was getting that vast wealth to have some spiritual guidance. So I think wealth can be a great burden if you don't know what to do with it. And I had a lot of direction from the faith on how to use that wealth and how to consider that wealth as a vehicle to make, to contribute to the betterment of humankind. Mm.
I mean, the whole guidance part, I mean, to believe in something that is bigger than yourself. And, you know, it's, I mean, I always say that for me, it doesn't matter if you believe in Muhammad or Jesus Christ or Baha'i or, I don't know, a garden elves. I mean, I don't care. For me, if you have something that you believe in, then I think you have something that is very, very valuable.
I would say it matters what you believe in, but it doesn't matter what you call it. So if you believe in good and you believe in love and you believe in kindness and you do that in the name of Muhammad, or you do that in the name of Jesus the Christ, or you do that in the name of Baha'u'llah, all of that's good. Now, if I believe in garden elves and I believe in all those same things, that's great. But if in the name of Jesus or in Muhammad or in Baha'u'llah, I'm doing bad things, then my belief is not so good. Mm.
Yeah. I mean, the greater belief should lead you to a place where, I mean, you have a conscious awareness about your values, your priorities, the way you focus in the day. What you need, what you don't need, who you don't need. And that's, I mean, for me, that's on my journey, that's been the most important part, to kind of be aware of that.
To me, the spiritual world is the source of all good and the source of all joy. So ultimately, if you've given up the spirit world, you can have everything. You can have money and fame. And I've recently worked with people like that, and you can see their misery. Mm-hmm. They don't think you can see it, but it's very clear to me. Mm-hmm. And I just feel sorry for them. I think that even though they're not particularly nice, I feel sorry for them. I'm like, wow, you should be a better human. You would be happier. I want you to be happy. I don't think that I want them, to get hit by a car. Maybe my initial reaction might be if they're particularly mean to me that day. But then I think about it and I say, you know what, that's a soul over there, and that soul is suffering. Even if that soul is being cruel to other humans, that's a suffering soul. And this is where my faith helps me, because it helps you. I think where faith helps you the most is when you hit bad times. And so it's that when we're in good times, you can make it with or without faith. I think, it's the easy times when you're cruising down Lazy River and the sun is shining, which it is doing today. I hear it doesn't do it that often in Denmark. But when you get into that storm, when the storm comes, when the winter comes, and you're freezing out there in the cold, where's your life raft then? And what's going to help you then? And so for me, in the times when life is roughest, when I'm dealing with maybe people who aren't so nice, when I'm dealing with situations which are a little bit difficult, and I'm in a lot of different things. I'm a philanthropist, and I'm an entrepreneur, and I'm a movie maker. And so I have a lot of opportunity to work with people that aren't as nice. And I try only to work with people I like, but sometimes you make mistakes. And so it's at those times when I really need my faith for my own happiness, for my own joy. And I think the biggest thing I've been learning this year is detachment. Mm-hmm. Even if someone does you wrong, you have to detach. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm learning. And it's hard for me, but I'm learning it. And it's a great lesson.
Mm. I mean, when you do detach, I've detached from a lot of people and a lot of things, and there is a certain grief with that. And and that's not a bad thing, because if you didn't have grief in that way, it wouldn't mean anything.
For me, it's less about grief than relief. It's actually, here in Denmark, I got a call, which wasn't a great call, about a particular business situation, and it was very difficult, and dealing with someone who's very difficult to deal with, and my company's kind of backed into a corner, and how do you do it? And I went to sleep, and I prayed a little bit, and I woke up the next morning, and I felt light as air. And I just said, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. I'll do it. In the United States, I think it's probably big here. Do you have AA here, Alcoholics Anonymous? Mm-hmm. And the center of it is the Serenity Prayer.
Yeah.
God help me to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change, the wisdom to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can. And so this is something I can't change. I can't change how this other person is acting. But what I can change is my reaction. And so I realized that my reaction has to be one of love.
When we were in Australia, I met this guy, and he was kind of dealing with my body, and he was giving me massages and stuff like that. And he was doing therapy whilst doing this. And he's telling me, do you know how to regulate your feelings? I think I do, but how do you think? And he's making this example with hot lava. If you get hot lava on your hands, just try and keep it and breathe through it, instead of distributing to your kids and your wife and your friends. Try and keep it, and then kind of relieve your way into it, because when you accept the things that are difficult, you can say, can I control this, or is this out of my control? And if it's out of your control, as you said, cross it out.
I think what I want to do with Wayfair, so in the three principles in Wayfair, actually there's four. There's Tara, who's president, Jamie, who's CEO, Justin, who is my co-chairman, and myself. And throughout this process of dealing with a very difficult production, we went through COVID, we went through an actor strike, Jamie, and there's been some frustrations on my part, Jamie has always said, remember, Steve, you're a Baha'i, when I get it, because I have a bit of a temper. And he says, remember, you're Baha'i. And then my first reaction is red, and my second reaction is almost like I've meditated and I let it out. And so that's kind of like what you're saying with the lava, and I'm learning how to hold that lava. Mm-hmm. And I'm learning how to, there's a good time to be righteously angry. You know, if a killer's sure. coming in your house and, mm-hmm. and hurting your family. But for the most part, anger doesn't do any good. And for the most part, if you can avoid a fight and if you can take the high road, that's the way to go. Mm-hmm. And what Abdu'l-Bahá says, and he's our exemplar, is to overcome hatred with love. And so, you know, those who've dealt with Wayfarer understand that. And I've had many, many people come to me and say, you know, I never knew there was a company like that. This was like nothing I ever dealt with. And, you know, Justin directed a film called Clouds. And I remember I went on set and the reaction of the people to Justin, you could just see that he had created an atmosphere there. It was incredible. Mm. And he had directed another film called 5 Feet Apart, the same thing. Justin is, you know, he's my business partner. He's my very good friend. He's an amazing human being. And he brings that to the set every day. Mm. And, you know, sometimes, you know, that I'll tell you, there's a certain type of person who doesn't like that. Mm. You know, if you're a bat, bats like the darkness. And so they're, you know, materialists are, there's a quote in the Baha'i writing, like materialists are like bats in the night. So if you shine a light on a bat, that bat's going to be repulsed by it. Mm. So Justin's biggest problem is occasionally his light is so beautiful and so bright that people who are in darkness are actually repulsed by it. Mm. But he's one of the most kind, loving, sincere, and genuine people I've ever met.
Mm. I think what happens sometimes is when you take the high road or have this light, you operate also as a mirror. And people, they see themselves in that mirror. A lot of people, at least, they will see themselves in that mirror and they will try everything to avoid dealing with it.
I agree.
And that's, I've had the experience since I've stopped drinking years back. And when people come up to me and they realize that I'm not drinking, it forces them to kind of evaluate, wait a minute, is that a thing? Is that something we're doing? How much am I drinking? Why am I drinking? You know? So it operates as a mirror when you decide I'm going to be better.
I was a little unusual. I never drank at all, never drank a drop of alcohol till I was 17 and a half. And that was the day I graduated high school. I had my first drink and I drank for about 6 months, not heavily. I never drank a lot. And after 6 months, I decided, I actually sat up one morning and did a T-square, you know, a decision-making tree like you do in business. What's the positive? What's the negative? And the negatives far outweighed the positives. So I made a decision when I was 18 and I said, I'm not going to drink anymore. That was over 40 years ago and I never started again. I just stopped and never started. So I was a party DJ during college and people were always looking at me funny because I wasn't drinking. And I said, I had no desire. Very occasionally in college, that's probably the last time I ever had a drink, I would have one drink because they'd be so forceful. I'd say, okay, I'll have one drink. So they'd give me one beer and I would nurse it throughout the night. It probably did that 2-3 times. And then since then, no drinks at all. Mm. And I don't miss it at all. I don't hold anyone else. I don't, if someone else drinks, I don't care. I'm the chairman of a company and been founder and chairman. And there's, when I go to a board meeting, typical board meeting, most people are drinking at board dinner and I don't care. In fact, I think the world of those people who are drinking because of the job they do during the day. And so, you know, I guess what I'm saying is I really don't care if anyone else drinks.
Yeah.
You know, it's just my decision not to drink. I'm not going to force it. But I do think, I will say this, if you did the T-square societally, it would be a no-brainer. In America alone, drinking costs $250 billion a year. And you have so many, you know, every family, including mine, I had to put one of our close relatives who was living with us at the time through treatment for alcohol. So I saw close up what has happened in every family. Every family has at least an extended relative who's an alcoholic. Mm. And every family has seen the wreckage of the life that they've led. And, you know, there's alcohol-related driving problems, medical problems. And so it's there. It's the tremendous damage to society. What I know, because I haven't had a drink since I was 18, pretty much, maybe, like I said, two or three in college, I can see that it's not needed. I've never felt in all these years like I've needed it. And I think that goes true for all society, except for an occasional medical, you know, sometimes for sterilization, alcohol can be useful. But in terms of drinking it, we are able as human beings to relax without it. We just have to learn.
Yeah. No, I remember when I was getting into that decision period. I mean, I've done several periods of not drinking. And then decision time came. And I mean, it was a no-brainer. But the thing is that I was afraid. I mean, was I able to be creative without it? Was I able to have these brainstorms? Was I able to create all the things that I've done without it? And looking back at it, I did that in spite of that.
I would agree. I think the problem is our souls and our failure to nurture our souls. We need to feed our souls every day. And just like the body, if we're not feeding the souls with good things, we'll feed the souls with bad things. And that's where the alcohol and the drugs come in. I don't think that's the root of the problem. It's a symptom of a much larger problem.
Yeah, but I think we can include food in that as well. I mean, there's a lot of, if you have a void in your body, you'll fill that with, I mean, even work. I mean, overworking, you know, like.
It can be filled with a lot of things. I do think we're in the West, in the developed world, we fill our void to a large extent with materialism. I live in a wealthy city, and I think that in most developed countries, people think it's okay because they have a nice car and a nice house. But if you look at them, you can, and I do observe people, a lot of people are not happy. And so you can't fill the spiritual void with material things.
I mean, since we've started this project, I mean, my email is filled with people, both female and male, but often males, 35 and up. And what they're writing to me is, you know, I have everything. I have everything that I thought would make me happy. But I feel stuck. I feel squeezed. I feel frustrated. And I can't tell anyone. So what do I do? And, you know, the first lines in my book is that, you know, I'm not a psychologist. So if you come to me with problems that is for a psychologist or a therapist, I won't answer. I'll just say, you know, I'll guide you this way. But if you have that void that we're talking about, I can help you because I've had it. I've had that void. And the more you face it and the more you're open about it, the more it heals.
Hey, follow us on social media. The goal is to make content with purpose, inspired by the conscious mindset, mixed with adventure and, of course, my thoughts. Find us on Instagram, TikTok, LinkedIn, and Facebook under Lasse Vive. Thank you. Now back to the conversation.
We've worked with a lot of people in Hollywood, and I would say I've worked with some of the most famous people in Hollywood. I got to tell you, I'll tell you about a couple I really liked. Scarlett Johansson, we produced a movie she directed. It's going to come out fairly shortly, probably next year. Its name right now is Eleanor the Great. I met her. I couldn't have been more impressed. I know she's Scandinavian too. She's part Swedish. Is that right?
Danish.
She's Danish. Oh, yeah. That's even better. So I picked the right person. Of course, she's beautiful. And she is my favorite actress. She was before, but she could not have been more gracious, more down to earth. She was very, I was watching her direct. We actually had the privilege of supporting her, directing her first film. She was an exceptional director. I could see she had great control of the set. But the thing I was most impressed with is when she came and met us, she wasn't dressed to the nines. She wasn't trying to look like a movie star. She was just Scarlett doing the job, just very simply doing the job. And obviously very intelligent too. I like I said, I couldn't have been more impressed with her. And of course, with her level of stardom, she could have been not that nice. We worked with Will Ferrell. He was wonderful. We actually did very well. We made a film which we sold at a very nice profit to Netflix called Will and Harper, about him driving cross country with his friend who's in his 60s and decided to transition from being a man to a woman. And it's really a friendship story between these two men, /now women. But we found Will Ferrell to be very easy to work with, very likable, really nice guy. We worked with Robert De Niro.
Okay.
And Robert De Niro, he worked on a movie, Ezra, which I love. If you get a chance to see, I don't think it's available here in Denmark.
What's it called?
It's called Ezra. It's about, and Rain's in that movie. That's one of the movies that Rain is in. It's about a father who is, he kidnaps his own son. He has a son who has autism, and the son is having behavioral problems. So the father and the mother, and they end up splitting up. The father doesn't want to put him on drugs. The mother does. The father gets angry, tries to punch out the doctor, gets a restraining order, and he actually ends up kidnapping his own son, whose name is Ezra. And there's a young man by the name of William Fitzgerald who plays the title role. He just jumps off the screen. But De Niro plays the grandfather in that movie, and he rewrote a lot of his lines and made them much better. Mm-hmm. He's a consummate professional, great to work with. So I just think there's a lot of people in Hollywood who are great, not everyone. And so I think what happens with the people that aren't that nice is it works for a while. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is people see through it. And we're part of a new vanguard, which is trying to change it. But Hollywood, if you look at the movies that Hollywood's putting out, I have a movie theater. It's a very interesting story. I have a family office. My landlord came to me a couple of years ago and said, you have a theater in the same building. It was in a different part of our building, and it was part of a chain. And he said, they don't want to operate it anymore. Do you want a theater? We'll give you the keys.
Hmm.
No charge. So I got this theater, which is really a great deal. It was losing, I don't know how many thousands, tens of thousands of dollars a month, $30,000-$50,000 a month for free. Isn't that great? And that's what I got. And then I put another couple million dollars into it and made it really beautiful. But we will not play any movies in that theater that are horror movies. We will not play movies that are exceptionally violent or too much sex, graphic sexuality or violence. We have a lot of movies that kind of hit the border because Hollywood's putting out so many bad movies.
Yeah.
And there's a few movies that we've actually played, and I've watched them, and we thought based on everything we knew that they would fit our mold, and they're never coming back again. But, so there's gratuitous sex, gratuitous violence, and just movies that kind of drain the soul. You know, a lot of the new horror movies are like that. There's a movie, I'll pick on one movie in particular that I saw just a couple minutes of a trailer, and I was just questioning, why was this movie made? Why would anyone go watch this? It was called Speak No Evil, and it was about a father, I think somewhere in this region of Europe.
He's also Danish.
What's that?
He's also Danish.
The actor in this?
The filmmaker.
Okay, so I don't mean to insult a Dane and a Dane in Denmark. Hopefully I'll make it out if you're alive. But he had cut off his son's tongue. And so the son, did you see clips for that movie?
No.
So
I can't watch stuff like that.
So we watched it as part of CinemaCon, all the big new movies coming out. And so there were a couple scenes where the son opens up his mouth to talk and he can't talk because he has his tongue cut out. And that's the whole movie. And I'm thinking to myself, why would anyone take 2 hours or an hour and a half of their life to watch this? Mm. And I think it's because art reflects life and life reflects art. And so we are in an international, worldwide depression right now. Mm. And we need to start nurturing our spirits.
Yeah.
Hollywood reflects this, our failure to do so. And so we're making movies that are uplifting, that are joyous, that will make you laugh, that'll make you cry, that'll make you think. And not everyone's ready for them yet, but we hope and we know that more and more people will start craving movies like that. Because when you're fed literally garbage and someone gives you a 5-star dinner, it's eventually people will take the 5-star dinner. We're making beautiful films like they used to make, films like, Good Will Hunting and Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile, when people made movies that, when you walked out, wow, that was great.
Mm-hmm. It's rarer and rarer that you walk out from that cinema and just go like, wow.
My challenge as the owner of a cinema and the owner of a movie studio, we're putting out 8 films, by the way, this year on various either streaming platforms or in theaters. And my challenge is reaching the people who, like you, just have kind of given up on going to the theater. So our audience is not the audience going to theaters for the most part. It's the audiences who have stopped going to theaters because they want something good and don't think it exists. Mm. And so we have to recapture their hearts. There are some people going to theaters who are still looking for good things, but a lot of the people, you know, the people or most of the people going to theaters right now, if you look at the top 10 films, are people watching horror films and Marvel movies. And it's not the type of movie I want to make.
Mm. No, I mean, with our kids, I mean, it will even work with kids when you kind of get them accustomed to watching quality, like
and
movies.
Vice versa.
Yeah.
And vice versa.
Exactly.
So I talked to a lot of kids about their movie taste, and I just was in a group, a Baha'i group, and one of the people said she loved horror movies. And I was thinking to myself, I understood why she loved horror movies, because that's what she was taught to love. I mean, personally, I can't see another reason to love horror movies. They're not very good movies, most of them. She actually said that a lot of them aren't very good, but she had this one that was very good. And I do have one horror movie that I like, one or two, but they're not really horror. They're comedy. What's the one with Simon Pegg? It's a zombie movie.
I have no idea.
Shaun of the Dead.
All right.
It's not really a horror movie, but it's a horror movie satire. Mm. But I don't... You know, I haven't watched enough horror movies to even know.
I mean, when you leave a movie like that, I always feel super stressed, and it my cortisol level is just off the charts. You know, I just don't want to watch that because it makes me feel bad. But what I was saying about these kids, when you kind of get them accustomed to watching quality, watching movies that we can talk about, you know, what happened here? What did he feel about that? What was the situation here? I mean, you can grow from that.
So I invested recently in a company called Tiny Souls, and we started it just this year. And in just 4 months, we have 300,000 subscribers.
Fantastic.
And within a year, we think we'll have 1 million subscribers, and I highly recommend it. Parents are dying for content, which helps, like you said, help their children, nurture their children, nurture their souls. Mm-hmm. We're a society starving.
Yeah.
For the nourishment of our souls.
Exactly. And then we're back full circle to what are we putting into our bodies? I mean, this is also a visual, you know, like what are we watching? What are we eating? What are we, you know, what are we smoking? Why are we putting all this stuff? It's because we have this void in our bodies, in our souls.
When you start opening up your soul, you can feel, like I can feel that from you. I can feel your spirit. I can feel your kindness. I can feel your thoughtfulness. You can feel that from other people. But I think most people go through life with their eyes closed spiritually. Mm. And so if I have one thing to say to people, it's open your eyes. Open your eyes and see the world. Mm. And I think, I'll say this. You remember the film The Matrix? I like to talk through film.
Yeah.
And The Matrix, its proposition was this, that we live in this computer-generated society. That's the reality we think we see, but true reality is actually what I would call hell. You know, you're sitting there in this thing, and machines are getting electricity from your body, and you're essentially a slave to the machines. I thought it was a very atheistic point of view. Even though it comes off as spiritual with Morpheus, I thought it was very atheistic. And so essentially, to sum it up, we think we're in heaven, which is computer generated, but we're actually in hell. Mm. And you have to open your eyes to see that. Mm. And I think the actual reality, and this is how I go through life, is the reverse. I think the reason why people are afraid to open up their eyes is because they think that we're in hell and they see all these terrible things. But those terrible things are because, very much because we have our eyes closed. Mm. Were we to open up our eyes and start living spiritual lives and stop with the corruption and the greed and the materialism and the atheism and the things that are destroying the world? And religious fundamentalism, by the way, just so you know, I'm not picking on atheists.
Yeah.
If we were to get rid of these things and start loving and having compassion and love and leading with that love and unity and the oneness of humanity, we would instantly have such a paradise that the earth would be unrecognizable. Mm. Imagine, just if you will, a world without any war. And, you know, people might say that's utopia. It's never going to happen. It's in the Baha'i writings. Mm. It's in the Bible, actually. It's very much in the Bible. It says there'll be 1,000 years of peace. And we Baha'is believe that we're entering that 1,000 years of peace. And I can see the seeds of it. You can actually see them very clearly. You know, since 1844, 75% of the inventions in the history of the world have been invented. And then you see massive societal changes in things like women's rights, racial equality, or you know, the acknowledgement that we're a single human race, and the idea that the earth is but one country and mankind citizens. Even Denmark, which you know is somewhat homogenous, not as diverse as maybe London, you're seeing people of all colors here and much more than you did in the past. So the world is becoming one. And it's up to us to learn to live like brothers and sisters. You know, the Bible, among other holy books, every holy book says this, says love your neighbor. But it appears the way we operate in the world that there's some asterisks there. And I just say get rid of the asterisks.
Yeah, but I mean, if we talk about the matrix, you know, I think for a lot of people, taking the pill, the red pill, is very inconvenient. And I have a lot of people asking me, you know, I'm one of those guys who I get up at 5 o'clock to meditate and to work out and to have a walk and stuff like that. And that's because I know that between the hours of 5 and 7 in the morning, that's when I'm best. This is when I work the best. This is when I get my ideas. You know, this is just how I am. But people are like, well, do I need to get up at 5 o'clock? And I'm like, no. But what you need to do is you have to start taking conscious decisions for yourself. You have to decide, what do I want to do? What's my dream? Who am I? What do I want? How can I make the world a better place? And that's inconvenient for a lot of people because it's like stopping eating bad food or stopping with alcohol or whatever. It's inconvenient, but it makes you a better person. It makes you a better human being.
And what I think is stopping people is actually not inconvenience, but fear. So inconvenience, yes, but truly underneath that quote-unquote inconvenience is a fear. So we all, in Baha'i classes, we talk about this analogy. Everyone's carrying around a box of rocks that's very precious to them. And they're afraid to let go of that box of rocks. It's their box of rocks or the bag of rocks. And sitting right in front of them is a bag of precious gems worth an infinite amount more than that box of rocks. So the question, including myself, I ask myself every day, what are the rocks that you're holding close to that you can get rid of and replace with precious gems? And let me tell you, from my understanding of it, it's always a material thing that's a rock and a spiritual thing that's the gem. So can I replace my greed and my materialism with love and kindness and detachment and compassion and, as you said, a desire to make the world a better place? We're taught in the modern world to be selfish. And the most obvious way to be selfish is to actually be selfless. Because it will make you happy and fulfilled. All those things you said, a better father, a better mother, a better friend. You do that by becoming selfless and you become happier.
Hey, follow or subscribe the podcast where you get it. It makes a huge difference to us and it means that we can keep getting exciting people in the studio and create inspiration to others out there. Thank you so much. Now back to the conversation. The whole thing about imperfect on purpose is also the fact that, you know, the acknowledgement that we're all here, we're all improvising in the end of the day. We're all trying to be the best version of us, of ourselves. And I think people are afraid of projecting this imperfection. They want to look perfect, but it's a fata morgana that it doesn't exist. There's no such thing. But if you do acknowledge that you are imperfect, this is when the good stuff happens, because then you can start, okay, I don't have to think about that anymore. Now I can start growing.
Again, it's fear. Like you said, it's this fear of letting go.
Yes.
And so, you know, maybe I would say start with just a breath. If you can do nothing else, just take a breath.
Yes.
And let go just a little bit. And the more you can do that, and then maybe the next day you can take 2 breaths or 3 breaths. And as you start meditating, as you start going a little deeper, reality starts clearing up.
I mean, and the funny thing about the breath is it's something that we all have, and so few people use it. And I had a guy the other day who was, he was very afraid of this particular meeting he had at his workplace. Every week he had this meeting, and he was very afraid of it. He had anxiety about it. And I said to him, you know, like, when you're in that meeting, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to breathe, like, to show everyone you're breathing, but try and breathe, because they won't notice. So instead of breathing only on the top of your lungs, try and really take it in and see what that does to your anxiety. And he wrote me the other day, and he's like, you know, it cured me.
I had a young man, oh, this must have been over 10 years ago, maybe close to 15 years ago. I had, so with my company, which is Paylocity, we had a telemarketing company. Our head of sales was having trouble hiring telemarketing companies. I was the CEO and he was the head of sales, so I couldn't necessarily work for him, but I could have run telemarketing for him. And I thought, well, I'll just start a company on the side, and you'll hire my, even though I own the company, you'll hire my company. That way I'm not technically working for him. And so I did that. And so I had a young man who was telemarketing for me, and he was struggling. And I said, I want you to only change one thing. I want you to meditate in the morning before you come in and telemarket. And he did that. And he immediately went from underneath his quota to above quota. I mean, instantly, and never went back.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was clear, because his mind wasn't clear. He wasn't thinking clearly. When you meditate every morning, when you pray, when you meditate, when you get deeper spiritually, you become, as you said, better at everything. Mm-hmm. I had a very distinct experience. I went to Akko, Israel. This is before I became a Baha'i in 2014. And I had a spiritual transformation, you know, instant, one day, September 12th, 2014. And I came back, and I'm a runner. I'm probably almost at the end of my running career right now because my back is hurting me. But I still run when I can. But I was running competitively, and I knew at the time I was just pushing my 49th birthday, and I knew I could run 3 miles in, what is it? That's off like a 5K, just under a 5K, in 19 minutes and 45 seconds, which isn't bad. You know, there's people who can run faster, but it's pretty good for a guy my age. And I went to run a little race. It's the first race I'd run since I've had my spiritual transformation. I hadn't even tried to run that fast in a month and a half. I think this was 6 weeks later. And I line up at the starting line, and there's a young kid, 17 years old, who's on his high school cross-country team. I said, how fast can you go? He said, 19 minutes. I said, I'll see you at the finish, you know. And he takes off, and he's in front. And I caught him at the mile mark and then just left him behind. And it felt so easy. It didn't hurt at all. And I ran 19 flat, 45 seconds faster than I thought I could run, which almost doesn't, in my whole life, has never happened. And it turned out that whole year was like that. I was running faster. I was playing basketball, and I just had an extra step. I was sleeping 4 hours a night and not tired, and just spent the rest of my time reading. I had gone up another level spiritually, and everything felt better. And the other thing that happened, two other things happened. I did not get physically sick. Usually I get a cold at least once a year, something cold or flu. Did not have anything for 18 months. And the last thing, which was really interesting, is I started healing people with my hands, which I've been doing ever since. And I didn't know what it was until about a year later when someone told me it was Reiki. And so I've been doing that ever since.
Wow. Oh, that's good. No, I think there's a lot of things when you go through life where you can look back. I mean, you've met my wife. I mean, I thought I was good at my job. But when I met her, I became so much better at it. And I mean, then you take that another 5 years and you go into spirituality and you become accustomed to breathing. And I mean, you thought that you had all these things. And I remember one particular episode where, I mean, I, at that point, was very full of myself. My ego was everywhere, you know, like I was making money. I was building businesses.
I've been there.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I had a lot of, I was very busy telling everyone how good I was and how much money I was making and all of that. And I remember that we went to this dinner with my wife's family. And I was doing my bit. I was telling everyone who I was and how cool I was and all of this stuff. And, you know, when we left that dinner, she's like, you know what? I really love you, but I don't love you because of that. The reason why I love you is because of the way you care for me, the way you care for your mother, you know, the way that you are acting towards your friends and my family. But it doesn't suit you when you keep talking about wealth and money and all of these quick fixes. It really doesn't suit you. And I just remember it just came just falling down. My whole house just fell.
Well, we as men are trained. It's interesting because women and men are similar in a sense. We're almost mirror images. Women are like that about their looks. Women in every country, I assume it's the same thing here in Denmark, women obsess over their looks, much more so than men. Maybe men want to be good looking, but we don't really care. When it really comes down to it, you know, men are not obsessed. Most men are not obsessed with their looks. And women spend so much more time on their looks, their clothing, etc. And it's because society is judging them that way. And men are the same way. We're judged on material. And so a man is more attractive if he's wealthy and he's successful to most women, but not your wife. And that's because your wife is such a good woman and such so wise. She knows what's really important. Mm-hmm. And there are women like your wife, but a lot of women are not like your wife. And so there's a lot of women who would be impressed by the things you were talking about. And I've been through that. And for me, I value the things that your wife values. And I'm still learning because, you know, we're unlearning what society taught us. And you and I both probably, you know, you know, we want to talk about, because we're men and we've been programmed that the more successful we are, you know, the more attractive we are, which is what ultimately it's about.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the big thing for me has always been, you know, getting the most. And it didn't really set me free until I started thinking, I just have to have enough.
Yeah.
When I have enough, that's fine for me. I don't have to be the biggest entrepreneur in the world, but I want to have enough so I can support my family and move to Costa Rica and do the things that I love and make me a happy person. Well, and then
it sounds like you've done that.
This is where we are. And this is, I mean, I just really appreciate the conversion that she really helped me with that. And I appreciate that for life.
I have friends like that too, that when I, you know, my business partners, I have my best friend back home, she'll tell me right away. She says, you know, she actually told me something like that very, very recently. She said, you know, I forget what she told me, but she said, you know, you weren't at your best when you said that. And you know, very similar, you know, you don't need to do that. And, we're all works in progress.
Sure.
And I'm working on it every day. And I had one of my favorite calls. Actually, I got a call while I was here in Denmark from my friend Joel, been friends with for many years. And Joel called me a couple of years ago and he says, "You're a bad rich man." I said, "What do you mean, Joel? You know, we've been friends for all these years. You don't like me?" He said, "No, I like you just fine. You just don't have all the accoutrements that a rich man should have. You don't belong to a country club. You don't have a private plane. I drive a Toyota Prius." You know, he's like, you know, you need to have a nice car so I can ride in it and a jet. And he was kidding me, but he was telling me, you know, just, you know, he was only partially kidding me. I think he would like me to get the private plane, but he pointed that out and I thought, yeah, I'm happy like this. And I hope you'll still be my friend, Joel, but I'm going to keep going and he's still my friend. I'm going to be a bad rich man. And the funny thing is he called me while I was here in Denmark and said, "Someone said the same thing to me." I thought, Joel, you're doing great then.
That's funny.
I think all rich men should be bad rich men. I think that wealth is really put on this earth to be shared. And so what I've decided to do is to give away the great, great majority. When I go back home on Monday, we'll be doing a ribbon cutting for Wayfair Foundation, and the great, great majority of my wealth will be given to nonprofits via the Wayfair Foundation. And so to me, that's the better way to, and you know, some to the faith to do what the faith needs. But to me, I don't understand why I would need to have hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars for myself. I'm my children, we've already given them their inheritance. I don't understand why you need a yacht or a plane. I mean, it's okay. I mean, there are, planes are nice. I've flown on a private plane. Yachts are nice if that's what you like, but I don't think that should be the focus of your life. And I think the focus of all of our lives, particularly those who've been blessed with great wealth, is to make the world a better place. And if we were to share, we share on the level that we could and should share, we would solve all the societal problems. Ultimately, we're all poorer when one of us is poorer. Because what happens is, in an area where you have a lot of large discrepancies between the rich and the poor, you get, and I've been to Honduras, I've been to countries like that where there's a huge gap. That gap causes problems for both the rich and the poor, both the poor and the rich, because the rich have to live behind bars and they have to live with security. And so it's a lot easier if we live in a society where, you know, you could still be rich as long as there's not extreme poverty.
Yeah. I mean, I always say it, you know, it's if you manage to get rich and you manage to make a success, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. There's really nothing wrong with that. Just make sure that it doesn't steal your soul, you know, because, I mean, I know for a fact, and I've been there, like buying material stuff, it'll make you happy for a couple of hours, maybe a day, and then you're back. And you're back to the same, you know, like, and in the end of the day, no matter how much money you have, there's no one on this planet who knows exactly what's going to happen when we die. There's no one on this planet who doesn't have a mother. You know, we're all the same in the end of the day. So let's treat each other with that respect.
And we're one. We're one. And so that's, you know, one of the major things from the Baha'i faith is that we're one. We're one human family. So as you said, we all have a mother and a father, and we all have you know, the same basic needs to eat. We have a lot of different cultural differences. I'm sure I don't, after just a few days, get all the cultural nuances of Denmark. I've asked a lot of questions. What I've heard is that people in Denmark are fairly reserved relative to the United States. So if I'm too talkative, let me know.
But you're fine.
You know, there's differences culturally, but ultimately, don't people in Denmark want to have a family and to have that family be safe and to be taken care of and to be happy and to be fulfilled? Aren't these the same things that we want in America? And, you know, same thing with women and men and the supposed tribes that we're in, whether it be a religious tribe or in America, I don't know if you've heard this, we have political tribes. And my friend came to me very upset the other day saying, if this candidate wins, the world's going to end. I said, well, the world will still be here.
Yeah,
and I will support that person if they win. I don't care which side it is. You know, I may not agree with some of the things they're saying, but I'm not here to fight over politics. It's a waste of my time. I can't really change things. My vote, yes, I'll vote, but my vote is not going to change the whole course of time, the whole course of history. But what I can do and what I do every day instead of doing politics is I spend my time on trying to heal humanity and invest in humanity and invest in making the world a better place. That I can do.
Yeah. I think the worst thing about politics at this point in the world is that instead of operating with our hearts, we're operating with our brain. And the brain is built basically to keep us alive and to make us survive and not be eaten. And that's why the brain reacts well to fear. And when you project something, you know, like, this guy is very dangerous for you, even like, and because he's from Mexico, for instance. And I'm like, this is just a person. He's just the same as you, but you're trying to make him, you're speaking to my brain right now. You're making him into someone who wants to steal my bread so I can't eat. So that's fear. And that's the worst thing about the politics globally, also here in Denmark at this point, that a lot of the things that are happening also on online and on social media is basically a fear factor.
And the fear is, you know, Hollywood plays with the same thing.
Yes.
You know, fear and greed. So it's our lower animal selves. You know, if you look at this, the fear and greed are part of that. All of the sins, you might say, this fear, this greed, excess lust, all of these things are our lower animal selves. Our true happiness is always found in the higher self. And the more you're living with love and kindness and mercy and compassion, the more joyful you'll be. Joy is also a higher thing. And so all of them go together. And what happens, you know, it's not logical. People are living in the lower self because they've gotten caught almost. And what they need to do is free themselves so they can fly. We need to free each other, and we need to work together to do that.
Exactly. Hey, for inquiries or a wish for understanding your next life choice, mail me at mail@lasevive.dk or go to my page, lasevive.com, for more information, newsletter, and much more. The site is both in English and in Danish. Thank you so much. Now back to the conversation. I like talking to you, Steve.
Thank you.
But we also need to listen to some music.
Creating me a pure heart. Oh my God. Oh my God.
Oy, that's really so nice.
So that was the great Luke Slott from Ireland singing. And my story, a couple stories, but I'll do this one recently. A couple weeks ago, I was at the Baha'i Temple in Wilmette, the only Baha'i Temple in North America. And who do I see but Luke Slott?
No way.
And I said, Luke, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm visiting. And he was with Jasmine Howard, who's another wonderful singer, who's got a voice even more beautiful than Luke's, which is amazing. And so he said he was going out to dinner. I said, well, I'm taking you out. Cancel your plans. So he came out to dinner with me. He and Jasmine came, and we took them out with a friend of mine, and we ended up going to a little place called Nuna Kebab near my house. And I saw a woman there who had a shirt on that said, support live music. So I said to her, I said, do you like live music? And of course she said, yes. And her husband said, why? Well, I said, well, there's two famous singers over there. If you ask them, maybe they'll sing for you. And her husband was very skeptical, but we walked over there, and they were very gracious, and they agreed to sing, literally singing for their supper. And Jasmine and Luke did a beautiful rendition of a song or a prayer called Blessed is the Spot. And there were two men and their two wives and the owner of the restaurant were gathered around this little mini concert. And the two women were crying their eyes out. It was so beautiful.
This segment of the podcast is called The Sound of Life. And it's really a proof of what music can do to your, I mean, and it's proven cognitively that it re-alters your brain when you listen to music like that. It can take you into the, I mean, if you have the wildest meeting, it can take you into war position. I mean, if you have a beautiful seance with your wife, it'll take you into the love. I mean, music can do everything, and it can just, I mean, I love the story like that. It's just, it just alters the mood, you know?
He's really such a beautiful soul, and you can feel his soul when he's singing. He's very passionate about the music and the words, in addition to having a very good voice.
Steve, it's been a huge pleasure.
Pleasure's mine.
To have you come into our studio. I loved it. Perfect conversation. Thank you so much.
The pleasure is mine. I hear that I'm going to get a great dinner, and I'm very happy about that as well.
They were singing for their supper, and you've been speaking for your supper. I think that's very appropriate.
I am happy to do so. And next time I take Luke out to dinner, I won't make him sing for a supper.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Steve.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you for having me here.
You're welcome. That was my talk with Steve. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. The thing that he is doing is absolutely spectacular, and he is changing so many lives with the way that he sees the world. And now I'm going to wish you all a great day. Take care out there. Memento mori. Live from the heart. Ciao.